Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for listening to Here and Now. There are thousands of podcasts out there. You chose this one. It's your thing. Listening choices are a part of who you are. The choice to support your favorite NPR programs is yours, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to donate to your station, then share why that's the kind of person you are. Tweet or create a public Facebook post with the hashtag WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Trump told reporters he thinks the Republican tax cut plan will pass next week, even though right now it may not have the votes. And he said Republican Roy Moore, who lost Tuesday's special election in Alabama, should concede the race.
The president was on his way to give a graduation speech at the FBI National Academy when he spoke at his helicopter and also slammed the FBI, calling the agency's Russia investigation a Democrat hoax. He was asked several times if he would pardon his former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who has pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russians just before the inauguration. Here's what the president said.
I don't want to talk about pardons for Michael Flynn yet. We'll see what happens. Let's see.
Yet. Is that leaving a door open?
Our weekly politics roundtable joins us. Jesse Hollins at the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Doing well. And Brian Bennett joins us today. He covers the White House for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Jeremy.
And Brian, let's start with tax cuts. There's been some last-minute jockeying going on. Senator Marco Rubio had said he wouldn't support the plan in its final form unless there's a big change, an expansion of the child tax credit. It now looks like that may have happened. But is there any fear on the part of Republicans that this bill won't pass?
This is an interesting last-minute gamble by Senator Rubio to really try to put a flag down for low- and middle-income families. I think we'll see maybe a few other stunts like this over the next 48 hours. And right now, Republicans seem confident that they're going to get it because they really believe that everyone's going to come together for the party to make the case that they need to do this to have a win for this year. But I think we're going to see some gamesmanship right at the last minute. People like Marco Rubio trying to hold their vote backs to get some of their priorities through.
But you think they'll eventually support the bill?
That's my guess, yeah, is that it could come down to the wire, but that there's enough momentum behind the Republicans they could move it through next week.
Well, then, Brian, I want to ask you, because it is a Republican-crafted bill, are they ready to get rid of the individual mandate? Sounds like they are, but estimates say it'll lead to 13 million people losing their health insurance. You have the father with ALS, A.D. Barkin, who confronted Jeff Flake on an airplane about his vote on this. He's in Congress this week in his wheelchair, begging lawmakers not to cut the health care that could give him a few more years with his child. You know, not a very good optic. Any hesitation, Brian?
There are senators like Jeff Flake who know that this is a really difficult issue for them. And I think that Roy Moore's loss in Alabama has emboldened those senators who have stood up to Donald Trump in the past, like Senator Flake. And it's possible they'll try to use that moment for some leverage to try to take it a little bit farther on the individual mandate. But yeah, we'll have to watch and see how the games play out.
Jesse?
Well, one of the things that we're seeing now is, for the first time, the power of the individual center, especially on the Republican side, because Mitch McConnell needs every single Republican for this to pass. So now we're seeing people like what Marco Rubio is doing, and it's not going to surprise me to see some other senators, other Republican senators, start bringing up their pet issues because McConnell needs them, and even one vote could scuttle the whole thing. So I don't think we're at the end of the gamesmanship. It wouldn't surprise me to see Susan Collins or Ted Cruz or Jeff Flake bring up their own personal issues that they want in this bill because McConnell needs them. He can't get it passed without him.
Well, while we're talking about the Senate, I just want to ask you about the earthquake that happened this week, the victory by Doug Jones, the Democrat, over Roy Moore in the Alabama Senate election. The Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was asked if the special election results were a referendum. Here's what he said.
This was a referendum. The middle class and suburban middle class people said, we want change. And when that happens in Alabama, that's happening everywhere in America.
Brian, what do you think this means, this victory? Obviously, it may not make any difference for the tax cut package because Doug Jones hasn't been seated yet. But what about next year?
Well, it definitely emphasizes that every single vote in the Senate counts. It makes senators like Senator Rubio and Senator Flake and others much more powerful in the Senate than they would have been otherwise. And also it gives momentum to the Democrats going forward. They feel like they're emboldened that their message was part of what broke through in Alabama.
Well, Jesse, you wrote about the impact of the African-American vote there.
Right. One of the things that we saw through both the Virginia gubernatorial election, the New Jersey gubernatorial election, and now in Alabama is that President Trump's first year in office has energized black voters. What we saw in Alabama was a voter turnout similar to what we saw for Barack Obama's two elections. So that has to be one thing that has the Democrats happy going into next year, is that the black vote seems to be energized for them. And this should worry some Republicans in some southern states and other states where black voters are concentrated, because people are now showing up to vote against Republican candidates. And that doesn't bode well for them down the line.
Well, go ahead, Brian.
One thing that I thought was interesting about Roy Moore's loss this week was President Trump's reaction. He had a pretty muted reaction in his tweets on Twitter. He congratulated Doug Jones on his victory. And I kind of saw an underlying message there from President Trump, which is, yes, this was a tough loss for the Republicans, a tough loss for me, but it was an election result, and I think we should respect it. And I think there was an echo of his own insecurities about his election result and wanting people to let go of that.
Well, some people are speculating it could also be that he's hoping for a Scott Brown moment. You know, as President Obama very graciously welcomed Scott Brown when he upset the election in Massachusetts, and then Scott Brown voted with him. So maybe President Trump is hoping for that same moment. But we were talking about race and its impact in many of the last few elections. And that kind of brings to mind Omarosa, the former Apprentice contestant and Trump's highest level African-American advisor. Now, she says she was not fired, as reports have it this week, not escorted off the White House grounds. And on ABC, she was asked her thoughts about the president's handling of issues involving race. Let's listen.
I have seen things that have made me uncomfortable, that have upset me, that have affected me deeply and emotionally, that has affected my community and my people. And when I can tell my story, it is a profound story that I know the world will want to hear.
Jesse, she might just be selling a book, you know, and when she
might.
Says, yes.
Right.
Right. But, you know, this is not a White House, despite its claims, that has diversity. And her exit has made that, you know, has really underscored that.
No matter how the White House or Omarosa spins it, it was not a graceful exit for her. And one of the things that everyone's waiting to see is how much will she actually talk about what's going on inside the White House. She has the ear of, I should say has, she had the ear of the president through his first year. We don't know what she knows or what was said inside the White House, and now we're all wondering what she's going to say now that she's out. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how she carefully walks that line between having been a former Trump official and what she can say now that she's free of the White House.
Well, speaking of former Trump officials, we heard President Trump talk about Michael Flynn, his fired national security advisor, at the top of the segment. Brian, where are we on the Russia investigation right now? What's happened?
So Republicans and the White House are hoping that Mueller is getting ready to wrap up his investigation. The president's lawyer, Ty Cobb, has said he was hoping that Mueller would wrap up his investigation of the president by the end of the year. Now, that sounds like wishful thinking, especially when investigators like Mueller get started on something. They're like a dog with a bone, and they're very unlikely to let it go. That said, you know, Mueller will continue to have to keep his shop open to move forward with the prosecution of Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager who has been charged.
Do you expect any more indictments?
It's possible. It's possible there would be more indictments. There's been some reporting that the list of people they want to interview over the Russia collusion question, they've interviewed everyone on that list at this point. But that doesn't mean that they won't find something that they'll want to go back to people for, and that something could be uncovered that could lead to another indictment, or they want to pressure a lower level person and indict them and try to squeeze them or get a plea deal out of them.
Yeah. Look, you guys, we'll have a week to go till Christmas next week. It's normally a time when, lawmakers maybe leave town and there's not a lot going on. But next week, of course, we have the tax bill. Is there anything else? It's the end of the year, and this is an administration that really wants to show that it's accomplished something. We have the FCC overturning net neutrality. Is there any other shoe that you think might drop next week?
Well, we know that on December 22nd, the funding for the government runs out, so there's going to be another battle on over expending that. The Democrats still want to try to insert protections for people brought to the country illegally as children into that bill. There's going to be a big fight over that.
Well, and don't forget that they got to confirm some more judges before they leave town as well. So we might see a whole rush of judges coming through.
Well, and there's talk of trying to take apart immigration as well. I know we're going to be talking about judges today. Jeremy.
Yeah, there was that unbelievable viral video of one of President Trump's judicial nominees just unable to answer a single question. Brian, did you see that?
Yes. Yeah, it is really amazing.
And
there have been a few of those picked off.
What would you say, Brian?
There have been a few of President Trump's judicial nominees picked off that have withdrawn their nominations because they were deemed unqualified. And even Chairman Grassley of the Senate Judiciary Committee felt like they weren't good picks.
And yet he's been able to get a lot more through than President Obama did in his first year. So we'll keep an eye on that. Brian Bennett, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and Jesse Holland, who covers race and ethnicity and politics for the Associated Press. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks
Thank
a lot,
you.
Jeremy.
As millions buy gifts this season for loved ones, we want to once again honor those who give gifts to people they don't even know. We honor all of them with our look at a group called Christmas in the City. It started 28 years ago as a party for about 100 homeless kids in Boston. This Sunday, almost 6,000 homeless kids and their families will get a day-long extravaganza. And the next day, Monday, Christmas in the City provides gifts for another 16,000 kids who have homes but not much else. And not one of the 3,000 volunteers is paid a penny, including founders Jake and Sparky Kennedy. How? Well, for one thing, they work on it all year. 2 years ago now, we sat in on a summer planning session.
All right, so now we're on the actual party, so we'll buzz through this and we'll get out of here. So Saturday set up. The great thing is we will have Christmas trees to be painted and we will have murals.
That's Jake Kennedy, no relation to the other Boston Kennedys, at his clinic, Kennedy Brothers Physical Therapy. About 40 longtime volunteers of every age sprawl across massage tables to get an update on this year's event.
They can work any hours they want. They won't get paid a dime.
Here's Sparky Kennedy.
So it started in 1989. Jake and his clinic had a Poland Springs bottle. People started putting change in.
But wait, why did you decide to do this, Jake?
Well, our oldest, she was maybe, 4 years old?
Two.
Well, anyway, she got too many presents. So I said to Sparky, this is embarrassing. Let's keep it to three. And we did. But then the relatives descend upon the house, and all weekend long she gets overwhelmed with presents. So she had no idea, what Christmas meant. And that's how it started. We wanted to show her, the other side of life.
Yeah, but as this is happening, 165 to maybe 400, 500, how are you, are you looking at each other at that point, Jake, and saying, oh, my God. What are we going to do? How are we going to pay for this?
Never.
Like the demand from the homeless population just grows and grows and grows. And it's hard to say no to a kid at Christmas time. But then the volunteers come up. So we don't worry about the buses because someone's doing it. We don't worry about registering the early people because someone does it.
This is what we saw in your meeting. You start to have sort of captains, right, who are taking over things.
Yes.
Mark, Lisa, volunteers, what should we know?
So signups are actually just opened, and they're going really, really well. But also another cool thing is there's an organization. Does everyone know what cosplayers are? They dress up and go to, Comic-Con and everything. So there's a group called Cosplayers for a Cause, and they want to come and help greet everybody as they come in dressed in their, amazing uniforms. Costume.
Okay, so everybody that's over 40, this isn't like Costco. This is cost as in costume.
I never heard of the term.
They're trying to outdo themselves every year, and then they call on their own volunteers. They call the student group, and they say, this is what I'm doing, so Spike and I don't worry about that.
What would you say now, Jake? What's the value of the food, the gifts, the entertainment?
Well, the convention center alone, they give it to us for an entire week. That's over $800,000 that they would charge us, which they do not. We're into the $4 million or something.
Did anyone ever say to you, stop it. You got to take salary here. Did you ever think it?
We've never thought it.
I was advised 1 hour ago by a very important man to take money out for administration. And I've told them a million times no, and we will always say no, because we just believe. We see the smiles on the kids, and we know they would not have this magic of the holidays if it wasn't for our volunteers.
Kennedy Brothers Physical Therapy, this is Sam speaking.
Okay, we fast-forwarded to about 2 weeks ago. The phones at Kennedy Brothers ring off the hook. Clients lift weights and sometimes jump up to receive gifts which are piled high. A steady stream of moms come in to register their children for the day-after party for needy kids. But as Sparky and volunteer Dion LeBlanc work at a computer, it's clear there might not be enough gifts.
Come in. These are all the Excel sheets.
Oh, so we still need a lot more presents.
We still have to get rid of these, and these are big numbers. I mean, this is what we keep.
And as if on cue, a man walks in with an envelope.
Yes, that's all. Okay.
Wait, did you just hand Jake an envelope for $6,000?
Yes, I did.
And I'm sorry, what's your name?
My name is Kevin Leary. I have a law office across the street.
So how do you get those? How did you get that money?
I just send letters out every year, and the checks come in.
Well, and that's how it works, I guess.
That's how it works. We're more to come.
Thank you so much for coming. We can't tell you how much we appreciate you helping us throw the best party in Boston.
Finally, it's the Sunday before Christmas. The small and big donations have transformed the Boston Convention Center's main hall into a ballroom packed with linen-covered dinner tables.
Oh, my gosh. Now, there are hundreds of tables.
He's going to be blown away.
I am blown away.
There's last-minute details.
I can't find where Tim's Catholic Charities is. Okay, Tim is, and his daughters are going to be team captains of Bridge Over Troubled Waters, so Hannah and Kate.
Okay.
They're going to be helping him.
Shelter captains, who will shepherd the groups of children through the day, get a pep talk from their general, Nancy McDonald.
All right, it's go time. You guys are the heart of Christmas in the City. You guys are the ones that really make it happen for these kids. The people that are coming to the party today that are living in shelters, they're living in hotels, they've had a really, really, really rough year, and we're here to give them the memory of their lives. Let's do it.
It's organized chaos.
That's Barry Chait, who's long done pro bono accounting work for Christmas in the City. He brought me into another cavernous room where the gifts are staged.
It looks like an airplane hangar.
What it is on the left, we have all the shelters alphabetized, and each shelter has all the gifts for the kids because each kid is getting a gift off of a wish list.
Okay, so there's these huge orange bins and wrapped packages as far as the eye can see.
Yep, and then the toy room is down there because if any child isn't happy, if they're crying because Billy got a basketball and they got a football and they want a basketball, they come back here and they exchange it for the basketballs.
It's an airplane hangar. It's huge.
And beyond the wrapped gifts stood thousands of backpacks waiting like sentinels. This year, two families bought and packed them all, but for years it was just one, the Trambetta family.
Many parents have their kids going to play soccer. This family, they go to the supermarkets and stand out line and ask for donations for Christmas in the City. They raise enough money, and then they go online and they research backpacks. Each kid will get a backpack, which we'll have in it, books, hats, stuffed animals. Here they come, the first kids.
Here they come. There's a row of volunteers. A gauntlet of volunteers, mostly college age, line both sides of a red carpet as the first of 150 busloads of families arrive.
Merry Christmas, y'all. Let's stay together. Stay together. We're going to ask you to follow these two lovely individuals. Merry Christmas!
There's a sit-down dinner, entertainment, choirs, big and small. Overseeing it all, Jake Kennedy.
Jake, do you ever get tired of this?
No. It's like, it invigorates me. I mean, I've already had tears in my eyes two or three times, so.
Just two or three?
No, already, but don't worry, there'll be more.
It's going to be a fun, fun day.
What does this mean to you as a mom?
It will help a lot, for me especially.
It's more than fun.
What is it?
I don't know.
It's joyful.
Yeah, joyful. It's a good time to spend with your family.
A worry-free time.
Yes. Yeah. I know what else is going to happen.
What?
The Winter Wonderland.
Oh, yes, it is. But before that,
is it hot?
A contingent of bagpipes signals the arrival of Santa atop a fireman's cherry picker.
Santa! Santa! Santa!
And then a curtain slowly rises. Now, I won't say you had to see it to believe it because I don't believe it and I was there. What's revealed is a Hallmark card come to life. Snow falling gently on an indoor carnival, complete with tilt-a-whirl, carousels, snowball fights, pony rides. There are also flu shots, pedicures, Patriots quarterback Tom Brady's hairdresser. Now, Jake Kennedy is the son of the former dean of Northeastern University. I guess he didn't have personal experience with homelessness, but asked him anyway.
I had no idea. I mean, when we talked to first year, I talked to a kid and I said, "What happened last year?" And he said, "Nothing." I said, "Christmas morning, what happened?" "Nothing. You didn't get any presents?" "No." "Did you have a celebration? Was your father?" "No." "Were you upset?" He said, "No, it was just like any other day." I think that point we said, let's not just get him presents, but let him experience what we take for granted, which is like the incredible magic of this season.
Jake's wife, Sparky, says when other cities ask her how to do this kind of all-volunteer event, she says start small like they did. Jake says, no, go big. If you fail and you still help just one child, you succeed. He tells the story of the day a formerly homeless woman came into Kennedy Brothers.
And all of a sudden, this look came on her face, and I said, what's wrong? And she said, are you guys Christmas in the City? I go, yes, this is what we do. With tears in her eyes, she said, my son is in college now, and if you ask him what is most important day of his entire life, it was when he walked into Christmas in the City.
You get emotional when you tell that story.
I do. I get every year I get emotional. Just, I mean, you don't understand on a group of people that have to wait in line, that no promises are kept. They don't know what school they're going to. They don't know where they're going to live. They don't know where the next meal is coming from. What it means to be treated like princes and princesses. It's just, why do we do it? I wouldn't miss it. I wouldn't miss it.
Jake Kennedy of Christmas in the City. And this year, for the first time, the public can go into the Winter Wonderland tomorrow before the homeless kids on Sunday. It's a fundraiser. For more, go to herenow.org. And while there, let us know about like-minded groups where you live. It's Here and Now.
South Africa's ruling party, the African National Congress, or ANC, is expected to announce a new leader on Sunday. The current party leader is President Jacob Zuma. It's been a bruising leadership battle in a party rife with internal disputes. In Jacob Zuma's home province of KwaZulu-Natal, there have even been murders among competing members of the ANC. Peter Granitz reports.
Police in KwaZulu-Natal province are investigating 36 murders since last year that they believe to be politically motivated, and they say the killings are within the ANC. Mayors, city managers, ward councillors, people active at the lowest level of political parties, they've all been killed, with very few convictions. Political analyst Protas Midlala pins the murders on two reasons.
Because of positions and tenders.
Positions in tenders, jobs and contracts, or for slots on candidate lists that determine who takes office after elections. Midlala says people lower on the list are hiring hitmen to kill people who would be higher on a candidate list or above them in the party hierarchy. Officials in the ANC and the police acknowledge that hitmen are being used, but blame it on a general culture of violence in the province, a large unknown amount of guns, and a high unemployment rate. The lawlessness, Mitlala says, is a sign the ANC has failed its base. The poorest South Africans don't have jobs, assets, or quality educations. Social scientist Mary De Haas has tracked violence in the province since the 1980s. She says the desperation creates increasingly violent competition for seats in local government.
You get into these positions as a councillor, and that gives you major income in terms of awarding tenders, getting kickbacks.
Political violence is not new to KwaZulu-Natal. At least 15,000 people died in the province in clashes between the ANC and its rival, the Inkatha Freedom Party, in the waning years of apartheid. But with the killing today largely within the ANC, there's been pressure on President Jacob Zuma to do something about it. He's been virtually silent. The party established a commission to investigate the killings, but even participants say it's unlikely to stop the corruption that leads to them. Testifying at the commission, former KwaZulu-Natal Premier Senzo Mnunu says even good ward councillors are often corrupted.
It becomes very powerful. It can move a woman or a man, and it can throw you on the other side. My turn or our turn to eat.
Provincial party leader Sihle Zikalala denied there was systemic corruption in the party. Instead, he blamed former apartheid-era dynamics for the violence, a common ANC target.
Are we to faithfully believe that the remnant of the apartheid past would have disappeared amidst political contestation for state power and influence?
The violent competition is expected to get worse. The ANC will choose a new party leader to replace Zuma by December 20th, and that person will be the ANC nominee for president of South Africa in 2019. Political analyst Mitlala says the race to succeed Zuma has splintered the party, and that's bad news in volatile KwaZulu-Natal.
I'm expecting the worst, before and after, because of the split, the camps within the ANC, and the branches are in disarray.
And he doesn't expect the vote to unify the party or stop the violence. For NPR News, I'm Peter Granitz in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal.
The fight is escalating between Patagonia and the Trump administration. The activist clothing company publicly disagreed with President Trump's decision to shrink the size of Utah's protected monuments. Now it's suing, an unusual move by a retailer, but part of a growing activism. Think of CEOs like Tim Cook of Apple, who spoke out about Trump's ban on transgender people in the military, among other things. After Patagonia announced its lawsuit, Slice Intelligence, which tracks online sales in the U.S., said Patagonia's surged at least five times. On the other hand, there's a cottage industry of Patagonia haters. They say the company panders to the pampered. And other companies have seen backlash. When Under Armour CEO said in February that President Trump was an asset for the country, the hashtag boycott Under Armour started up. The company's stock was downgraded. And Howard Schultz, the executive chair of Starbucks, was widely ridiculed after his Race Together campaign. Remember when baristas wrote phrases on drink cups as an effort to combat racism. Well, Ronnie Chatterjee is associate professor of business and public policy at Duke University. He and others wrote a piece for the Harvard Business Review titled The New CEO Activists. Ronnie, when you watch Patagonia from the sidelines there, your thoughts?
Well, I see Patagonia and their corporate activism as just the long-term sort of unfolding of a broader phenomenon of CEOs and companies entering the political arena, with CEOs like Tim Cook and Howard Schultz speaking out on state, local, and federal laws. And in some ways, Patagonia is among the most likely companies to do this kind of thing. They describe themselves as an activist company, that the reason they're really in business is around protecting and preserving the environment. So I'm not surprised by Patagonia, but I do think it is part of a broader trend of CEOs and companies getting involved in politics.
Well, but you remind us of the Michael Jordan rule. You know, remember, Republicans buy sneakers, too. This idea that Republicans are buying Patagonia as well. Some of the people that we spoke to on the air who were in favor of Trump shrinking the amount of protected area considered themselves conservationists and people who use this land and might also buy this product. So what kind of risks are there?
There's a tremendous amount of risk and also opportunity when CEOs and companies get involved in politics. You know, in the old sort of model, companies want to be neutral. The idea was, why would you want to alienate 50% of your consumers? And in a polarized country, why would you want to take a controversial political stand? But here's what's changed. Because President Trump and his actions is such a Rorschach test for so many people, you either are for it or against it. People are increasingly looking to companies to kind of state their positions. And in a world of social media where, you know, basically it's a microphone that's always on, companies are getting barraged with these kinds of questions about where they stand. And if they don't take a position, they're likely to seem less authentic and less attractive to consumers. So I think that's what's driving a lot of this.
You mentioned Tim Cook and Apple denouncing freedom religion laws. But as critics pointed out, Apple continues to do business in countries that persecute LGBTQ individuals. So what kind of backlashes can a company face if they're seen as hypocritical or if they're seen as trying to make a buck off their beliefs. I mean, you have Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke calling Patagonia a special interest group. You know, it's shameful and appalling that they would blatantly lie, according to him, in order to gain money.
This is right. So when companies enter the political arena and issues are already politicized, they're going to see a huge amount of opposition on the other side. And you saw that when Tim Cook spoke out against RFRA in Indiana, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You saw that around companies speaking out against HB 2, House Bill 2 in North Carolina. What happens is the critics are saying, look, your practices are not consistent. You're speaking out about a law here in the United States, but you're supporting unfair labor practices or discrimination in other places, whether it's around the world or different parts of the U.S. And so companies are going to be forced to be more consistent on these different positions that they're taking. And there's much more transparency about what companies are doing around the world. And so I imagine that a lot of activists and stakeholders and interest groups are going to be putting pressure on companies like Apple, Patagonia, Starbucks, Under Armour to be consistent throughout their entire operations. So that's going to require a big sea change in corporate America.
They have to be prepared for that. But you mentioned those companies protesting the religious freedom law in Indiana and also the bathroom bill. But they didn't just protest. They pulled business out. They, in some cases, said that their employees couldn't travel there. How well does that work?
Well, this is a very interesting phenomenon. You're right. They're using their economic leverage. So when HB2 came along, PayPal and Deutsche Bank and a few other companies said, we're not going to create jobs in North Carolina. We're not going to continue our planned expansions in North Carolina. And the same thing happened in Indiana. And the same thing was threatened in Texas when they were looking at a similar religious liberty law. For critics of the companies, they say that using that economic power to blackmail state legislatures, to override the will of the voters, if that's the case, is not fair. And what's really interesting is you see the same folks who are upset about corporate power in politics, let's say the power wielded by the Koch brothers or folks that are supporting the conservative side, cheering on, right, Tim Cook and some of the progressive CEOs with their positions on these issues. And you see some of the folks who are really critical of Tim Cook and Howard Schultz actually benefiting quite a bit from other companies being involved in politics. And so I really see this as becoming more of a partisan issue. Companies are involved on both sides of the political debate, and whether you like it or not depends on where you stand.
Right. There's a goose and gander effect here. I mean, if it's good for your goose, it's going to be good for someone else's gander. For instance, David Green, founder and CEO of Hobby Lobby, this is the family-owned chain of craft stores, was the one who opposed the Obamacare requirement that health insurance for employees include coverage for the morning after pill and other birth control forms. So this isn't only happening on one side of the political spectrum.
That's right. Dan Cathy from Chick-fil-A, another conservative Christian business leader who spoke out against gay marriage and faced some backlash against that, but also some folks who said, hey, I'm glad you're speaking out and I'm more likely to go to Chick-fil-A, which is exactly what you found with Patagonia and their rocketing sales in the past couple of days. So this is where companies are facing new terrain. When you enter the political environment, you might galvanize people who agree with you, who have intense support for the position you've taken, but you're also going to potentially upset people who disagree with you, leading to boycotts or social media campaigns and hashtags that could ultimately hurt your business. That's what makes being a CEO activist so risky and interesting nowadays.
There was the hashtag that Golden State Warriors player Steph Curry got behind, a boycott Under Armour, after Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank said that the president was a real asset for the country. You know, and I'm reminded, too, the New Balance CEO also got in trouble. He's somebody who wants to have more products made in the USA. So he tweeted out something about Trump's anti-trade agreement policies. He had a world of hurt. People were destroying, you know, burning their sneakers on videos.
And this is where President Trump in particular is kind of scrambling the political calculus for a lot of companies. So you're right. The CEO of Under Armour spoke out in a statement supporting President Trump. And then one of his major endorsers, Steph Curry, came out against that. And, you know, given that many folks in the National Basketball Association, including the Golden State Warriors, opposed President Trump's policies on a wide variety of topics, chose not to go to the White House, that conflict between Under Armour, you know, a retail company, and their biggest endorsers was a huge deal for the company. And later they had to walk it back, as you remember, with a full page ad in a Baltimore newspaper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, politics is one of these full contact sports. And you saw it at the beginning of the Trump administration when President Trump, even before he was inaugurated, got involved in the carrier deal in Indiana, really, you know, calling CEOs directly, asking them not to move jobs to Mexico and other places. So you're seeing much more direct interaction between government and business through Twitter, but also through these back channels. And whether it's the CEO councils that the president had and were dissolved, or Patagonia facing direct tweets from the House Natural Resources Committee, which says that Patagonia is lying to you in response to their original ad. So you're seeing sort of back and forth with companies and government officials going at it.
So Patagonia has a director of philosophy, you know, someone whose job it is to help the company frame how they approach the world. There are organizations like BALI, Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, or SBN, Sustainable Business Network. They've been around for a long time under different names. People like Ben & Jerry and Stonyfield Farm and Eileen Fisher, who are devoted to taking a stand as well as making a good product. What advice do you have for CEOs who might be deciding, you know what, I'm going to edge into this world?
My advice would be, based on the research we've done, that you have to be authentic. You can't rely on an outside agency or some consultant to tell you what issues to care about. You have to choose those issues to be active on based on what your employees, your board members, and the management team themselves really care about. And I think people see the authenticity in all the different things you do, from your business operations to your corporate social responsibility initiatives to the stands you take in politics and otherwise. And so I think picking something you really care about that's authentic, but also carefully preparing for the inevitable backlash, understanding where your consumers are and where other important business stakeholders are, and being ready to provide them a response for why you've taken a controversial position. Those would be my two big pieces of advice for CEO activists.
And we're going to see more of them, it sounds like.
I think you will. I think this is only the beginning.
That's Ronnie Chatterjee, Associate Professor of Business and Public Policy at Duke University. Professor Ronnie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
PepsiCo pre-ordered 100 Tesla semi-trucks this week, the largest order to date for the electric vehicles Tesla unveiled in November. Anheuser-Busch, Walmart, and DHL have also pre-ordered trucks. Tesla's electric trucks are expected to go into production in 2019, and they could change the trucking industry. Joining us now is Steve Tam, who's the vice president of America's Commercial Transportation Research Company. And Steve, one of the things we're hearing is that one of the Tesla models will be able to go 500 miles on a single charge. Is that enough for today's truckers?
Many of the what we call regional trucking companies, so they have routes where they'll go out and back in the same day or maybe out a day and back the next day, can certainly take advantage of a truck with that type of a range.
But if you're driving a longer distance, let's say you're a trucker who's going cross country, if you had a 500-mile range on a single charge and let's say that it took you an hour to recharge the truck, is that enough or is that going to slow things down too much?
For now, that'll slow things down probably too much. Truckers are limited in the number of hours per day that they can drive and that they can be on duty. So taking a big pit stop like that to refuel, if you will, is probably not conducive to that business model. But we look forward to developments in battery technology and charging technology both that, you know, hopefully someday will make it applicable for those cross-country runs.
Well, what about the charging infrastructure that's in place now? Are we ready to handle electric trucks?
It's early days for that process. And that's, I think, part of the reason that you're going to wait until 2019 to see production, because we've got to let the charging infrastructure catch up and mature. So looking at, you know, the types of truckers that might adopt this technology, hopefully they'll be able to partner with their customers for charging locations, or perhaps even with their own satellite facilities to recharge.
What about the cost of the truck itself? A lot of these companies that are pre-ordering are having to put a little down payment down. But how does the cost of the truck and the operating cost compare to standard diesel trucks?
So for the 500-mile truck that you just mentioned, the price that Tesla has announced on that is $180,000. That's about $50,000 more than a comparably spec'd diesel truck. But until we see all the numbers and understand how all that works and fits together, we kind of have to reserve judgment to see whether there's actually a, what I would call a viable economic case for adoption.
But a lot of these companies obviously are not reserving judgment. They're making these pre-orders. Are you surprised at how many of these trucks have already been pre-ordered?
No, I'm not. You know, and that's one thing that we have to give Elon Musk credit for. Tesla has done a fantastic job of just whipping the level of interest to a frenzy within this space. And quite honestly, we need that. We need the interest and we need the investment so that we can continue to do research and development work to make it more appealing to a broader audience. So extending the range that the trucks are able to run as well as bringing that cost down. So exactly the things that need to happen are what are happening right now.
Elon Musk does do a great job of whipping up excitement about things. And he does make a lot of promises. But then when I think about that, I also look outside and see Teslas on the road. So maybe he'll actually be able to deliver.
I think we'll see them on the road. The question is, you know, how many of them and how quickly? Those are the big unknowns. Yeah.
What about the other companies that are getting into this business as well? We saw a company called Thor come out with an electric truck this week. What other companies are trying to compete?
Yeah, there are a number of them out there. Probably the largest competitor Tesla faces is a company called Nikola. They actually announced their truck in December a year ago, and it is conceived as a hydrogen electric hybrid. And they've got 25,000, not orders, but reservations for orders for their truck. So again, a tremendous amount of interest in alternative fuels that, you know, will make the environment cleaner, as well as hopefully save some trucking companies some money on their fuel bill. And quite honestly, even the traditional truck manufacturers are very interested in what's happening right now. And most, if not all of them, have electric trucks under development, either here in the United States or in Europe.
So if several years from now Elon Musk's dream comes true and everybody's trying to switch over to electric trucks, what kind of difference would that make for the trucking industry? I'm thinking for the environment as well, because you'd have a lot fewer trucks running on diesel.
We certainly are under mandates right now, federal mandates in the U.S. to reduce tailpipe emissions. And so this potentially becomes a solution that helps us reach those mandates and those goals. And you know, trucking companies in general, you know, want to do the right thing as far as environment's concerned. But many of their customers are pushing them. And that's, for example, why you're seeing the Pepsis of the world and the Walmarts of the world stepping up and saying, yeah, we'd like some of these trucks. We want to try them out and see how they do. Fuel costs are typically 20-25% of the operating expenses of a long-haul trucking company. So anything that they can do to reduce that, they're willing to go after. So if this technology can deliver, there could be some very positive opportunities.
That's Steve Tam, who is the vice president of America's Commercial Transportation Research Company. Steve, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
And by the way, in the Tesla Semi, the driver's seat is in the middle of the cab and the windows don't roll down. You can see a picture at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.